This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. The Russian Defense Ministry says it has repelled Ukraine's attack on the Crimean port city of Sevastopol, which is home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. Israelis have taken to the streets for the 28th week in a row to voice their opposition to judicial overhaul plans proposed by PM Netanyahu. And the number of people killed in floods and landslides in South Korea rises to 33, as rescue operations are underway to find those trapped in a flooded tunnel.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The Russian Defense Ministry says it has repelled Ukraine's attack on the Crimean port city of Sevastopol. The ministry in a statement said it destroyed 7 aerial and 2 underwater drones that were trying to attack targets in and around the city. It said no casualties or damage were caused. Sevastopol rejoined Russia in 2014 after a referendum. The city is home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. It has been the scene of drone attacks by Ukraine since the breakout of the war in February of last year. The EU Council President says peace and normalization between Azerbaijan and Armenia can be achieved by stopping violence and harsh rhetoric.
As a matter of priority, violence and harsh rhetoric should stop in order to provide a proper environment for peace and normalization talks. I also reiterated my intention to invite the Armenian and Azerbaijani leaders for another meeting in Brussels after the summer, as well as for another pentalateral meeting with the participation also of the leaders of France and Germany in Grenada in the margins of the next European Community Summit.
Michel said the current state of affairs is clearly not sustainable and in no one's interest. He made the remarks after trilateral talks with Azerbaijani and Armenian presidents. In the meeting, they discussed possible steps to help bring the situation back to normal in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. This comes as Russia offered to host the two countries' foreign ministers and suggested a future peace treaty could be signed in Moscow. The Nagorno-Karabakh region has been at the center of a decades-long dispute between the two countries, which have fought 2 wars over the mountainous territory. The region is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but has a primarily Armenian population. Italy's far-right government keeps broadcasting that the country's GDP is on the rise, despite the fact that wealth distribution across the Italian peninsula has never been so uneven.
A real indicator of economic growth of a given nation, many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is therefore all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD Economic Outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over 1 in 4 people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%. La crisi economica
legata anche al PIL. As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%. The picture is the same across the whole of Europe too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced also in the old continent over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
More than 100,000 Israelis have flocked to the streets of Tel Aviv to protest for the 28th consecutive week against the controversial reforms advanced by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right coalition. In Tel Aviv, protesters unrolled a massive banner reading SOS while blocking major highways and disrupting operations. Protesters brandished and lit torches outside of Netanyahu's home and demonstrated in the coastal cities of Herzliya and Netanya. The mass protests are gaining momentum as the Israeli parliament gave initial approval to a key portion of the overhaul earlier this week. The legislation package would roll back some of the Supreme Court's powers and give the ruling coalition decisive sway in picking judges. The bill still needs to be approved in two more votes expected by the end of the month before it becomes law. Israel's labor union and medical association, military reservists, fighter pilots and business leaders, as well as the regime's allies, namely the U.S., have all called for the halt of the plan. Protest leaders promise further days of disruption lie ahead. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says the controversial reforms introduced by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu could lead to strikes like the one which happened back in March.
The strike that happened last March is probably going to be called again if things continue. This will decimate the Israeli economy. Now, Israel is self-destructing as we watch it, and that's not a bad thing, certainly. But one thing that's important is that the Israelis, people who are demonstrating against injustices that are going to be perpetrated upon them. They don't care about the injustices that are being and have been perpetrated on the Palestinians for decades. It's the idea that they're going to be negatively impacted, and they're Israelis, they're Zionists, and they won't put up with this. So, but Netanyahu is holding fast against huge numbers of his people, against all of Israel's allies, but he's still maintaining this desire for this judicial overhaul. They want to be able to violate current laws and international law with complete impunity. They want to be able to basically commit genocide against the Palestinian people, and there has been minimal restrictions of that over the years, but they want to remove those minimal restrictions and just have a free rein to do whatever they want to for Zionist Israelis and everyone else be damned. And this is what basically is going to be the outcome of this overhaul.
The Israeli army has fired tear gas towards a Lebanese member of parliament who was touring an area near the Israeli-occupied Sheba Farms. The Lebanese lawmaker, Qasem Hashem, was accompanied by a group of journalists. Several people, including Hashem, have reportedly been injured. Israeli forces demanded that journalists leave the area, despite the fact that they were in Lebanon's territory. The area near Lebanon's southern border has recently witnessed tensions after Israeli occupation forces erected a barbed wire fence and constructed a concrete wall around the entire occupied village of Al-Rajar. Correspondent in Beirut, Mayam Saleh, says Israel is capturing more areas in southern Lebanon amid the inaction of international organizations.
Now, what we are looking at is something that is considered by Hezbollah, and they have been monitoring it, and it has been also explained elaborately by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah very recently. He spoke about how Hezbollah have been monitoring the situation, and the Israelis have been basically taking in, bit by bit, more Lebanese land, especially in the area of the village of Ghajar. Now, the Ghajar village's situation is a bit different from what we have in the Shabab farms. At the Shabab farms, we have some complications there, since in the United Nations, it is not clear whether it's Syrian or Lebanese. The Lebanese say it is a Lebanese territory. Even Syrian officials have told Lebanon, but we're yet to demarcate that area and to make it official. But the Ghajar village is officially Lebanese. We have Lebanese documents. We have people who own that property, and they clearly say it is Lebanese. It has been since the demarcation between Lebanon and Palestine. Now, that is where the problem lies, since the Israelis are very openly taking more land from that village. So what Hezbollah decided to do, since they have called on the Lebanese government on and on for the past year, to take things into their own hands, to follow things up diplomatically. And when things were not solved as such, or the international players, the United States, they did not really heed to the call of the Lebanese government.
In South Korea, at least 7 bodies have been discovered from a flooded tunnel, as days of heavy rain have caused deadly floods and landslides in the country. At least 15 vehicles have been trapped in muddy waters in an underpass in the central city of Cheongju. Rescue operation is underway to find people still remained trapped in the tunnel. The latest fatalities have brought the total death toll to at least 33. Most of the other deaths have happened in the North Gyeongsang region, or Gyeongsang region, where landslides have destroyed whole homes. South Korea has been hit by heavy rainfall since July 9, which has intensified in recent days. It has caused flooding, landslides, and power cuts across much of the country. The Southeast Asian bloc ASEAN has held a security meeting in which top diplomats from the U.S., China, and Russia were in attendance. Some of the issues discussed were the disputed South China Sea, the Ukraine war, and North Korea's missiles. But the issue of most concern, the stability of the region. The 27-member ASEAN Regional Forum meeting in Indonesia. In attendance, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, China's top diplomat Wang Yi, and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Officials from Japan, South Korea, the U.K., and Australia were also present. Blinken and Lavrov's presence at the meeting was filled with tensions, but no bilateral talks would take place. Issues like Myanmar were still of major importance to the bloc. The Indonesian Foreign Minister did not waste any time addressing what was on her mind. She likened geopolitical tensions in the Indo-Pacific as a Cold War in hot places, in reference to U.S. provocations against China.
Some say the Indo-Pacific is experiencing symptoms of a Cold War in hot places. The Indo-Pacific should not be another battleground. Our region must remain stable, and we intend to keep it that way.
The ASEAN chair, Indonesian President Widodo, said the gathering aimed to seek solutions rather than exacerbate regional and global problems. Yet the U.S. Secretary of State failed to see the concern of ASEAN when it came to the U.S. provocations against China.
I think we share the same vision for the region that we share, a free, open, secure, prosperous, connected, resilient region. And the work that we're doing together is trying to make that vision real.
The former Chinese ambassador to the U.S. believes that the United States only pays lip service to the ASEAN centrality.
ASEAN centrality is one of the most important principles in regional cooperation in Asia-Pacific. And ASEAN countries attach great importance to that. We in China also attach great importance to that. Frankly, I think the United States very often just pay lip service to this principle. They also talk about, well, they like this idea.
Indeed.
But watch what they are doing. There's no ASEAN in Quad. There's no ASEAN in AUKUS. So where is the central role of ASEAN?
The ASEAN centrality emphasizes the association's dominant regional role to overcome common challenges and to engage with external powers. The U.S. has been criticized for building mechanisms and initiatives in the Asia-Pacific region, bypassing the ASEAN, even though it says it respects the ASEAN centrality.
More countries moving away from the U.S. dollar as India and the UAE agree to settle trade in their national currencies. The agreement was signed during a visit by India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi. India's Reserve Bank says the arrangement will enable the development of a foreign exchange market between the Indian rupee and the UAE dirham. Recent years, there has been an accelerating trend toward de-dollarization. Last month, the U.S. Treasury Secretary said Washington should expect a gradual decline in the dollar's share of the global reserve. Janet Yellen acknowledged that the U.S. use of sanctions has motivated some countries to look for alternative currencies. And finally, in our broadcast, record temperatures are scorching parts of Asia, Europe, and the U.S., as forecasts warn of a dangerous heat wave around the world in the weekend. The U.S. National Weather Service has warned of, quote, an extremely hot and dangerous weekend with risk to life. This is amid a heat wave that is exposing over 100 million people in the south to temperatures of up to 48 degrees Celsius. Historic highs are also being reported in Europe. Italy is being hit the hardest. It has issued red alerts for 16 cities with temperatures forecast to hit 48 degrees Celsius in Sicily and in Sardinia. That would be an all-time record high in Europe. Record heat is also searing Asia. It has triggered temperature alerts in Japan and in China. Wildfires in Canada have burned more than 10 million hectares this year, a record-breaking figure which will continue to rise in the coming weeks. That's according to government data. The country has seen a total of more than 4,000 fires since January. 900 of those are still active. The scale of the fires and their multitude have forced authorities not to intervene and let the majority burn. Many of the fires are far from inhabited areas. However, more than 150,000 people have been displaced, and a firefighter died on Thursday. In the U.S., the smoke blown in from the wildfires have caused hazy skies and dangerous air quality. Experts have warned that cities like Chicago and New York may soon have the worst air quality in the world. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tell a little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of life.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful.
Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday of summer, July 16th, 2023. I'm Atefer Fani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special, as you may know, is the Sunday program where your views and outlooks are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. And if you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received reception reports from around the world, from Aaron Teo from the Philippines, from Avinash Chikant from India, and from Akiyoshi Teraoka from Japan. So Aaron, Avinash, and Akiyoshi, thank you for these reception reports, and thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and your favorite program, Listeners Special. We want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And let's see who has sent us email or a letter from around the world. Yes, from India, we have an email from Jawahar Almeida. From Japan, Akiyoshi Teraoka has sent us a piece of email. Again, from India, Avinash Chikant from India has sent us an email. Manfred Manke from Germany has sent us a piece of email. And the last but not the least is an email from the Netherlands, from Rob den Boer, one of our regular listeners. After a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. This is another edition of Listeners Special, and here we have an email from one of our Indian listeners, Jawahar Almeida. Jawahar says, "Dear sir or madam, I would like to inform you that your signal is heard with interest thousands of miles away in other countries. I have listed the details of programs on my reception, and I trust you will find them of interest to you. Reception quality was fairly good. I have attached an audio clip. Those were the details on my reception. If my report is correct, I would greatly appreciate your verification card to confirm the same. This will serve as a nice remembrance of contact with your station, besides adding to my collection too. I would be pleased to receive a verification card for this channel. Thank you once again for the good service, and my best regards to all of your staff. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Jawahar Almeida from India. I and my colleagues do send our warm appreciations to you for this great email. It's good to know your views about the quality of the broadcast. Jawahar Almeida from India, please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as verification to your email. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. So let's see what Akiyoshi Teraoka from Japan has sent us. It's a piece of email from Akiyoshi. Akiyoshi says, "I'm pleased to inform you that I have caught your radio broadcast. The modulation was shallow and the carrier was well present, but little of the program could be heard. Only faintly could make out that a man was saying something. If the details in this report are found to correspond with your station log, I would appreciate it very much to receive your QSL or your letter. Such a document would also serve as a nice remembrance of contact with your station. I trust that this report will be useful to your technical department. I'm worried about the postal services between Japan and Iran, therefore I decided to use an email this time. Best regards. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, Akiyoshi Teraoka from Japan. Thank you very much for sending this email to us. But we are so sorry for the trouble you had regarding the quality of the signals. But Akiyoshi Teraoka from Japan, don't worry about anything, because our technicians and engineers in Iran will fix the problem if the problem is on our behalf. Don't worry about anything. And please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as verification to your email. Akiyoshi Teraoka from Japan, write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. We wish you all the best. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. One of our listeners from India, Avinash Chikat, has sent us a piece of email. Avinash says, "Dear IRIB, warm greetings. I'm pleased to report the reception of your English language transmissions of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on shortwave. These transmissions I monitored when I was in Al Ain, UAE, where I am currently working. I hope that you'd find this report of some use. If found correct, kindly verify these with your QSL cards. Please send the QSL to my address in India, as I will be in India for the summer vacation. I'm interested in collecting postage stamps from across the world. It would be great if you can send a few used postage stamps from Iran if you have any to spare. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Avinash Chikal from India, and we are so grateful for this writing. We wish you all the best in your life and work. You said you're from India, but you're currently working in Al Ain, UAE. We wish you all the best in your life and work, and we're so happy to hear that you will have a summer vacation in your country in India. Okay, my colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL or EQSL to your email address, because sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio is not possible at the time. So at the time being, we just work with email and electronic issues. So please accept our EQSL as verification to your email. Anyway, we wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Manfred Monkey from Germany, one of our regular listeners and old listeners, has sent us an email. Manfred says, "Dear sirs, I had a great pleasure of receiving your radio here in Germany. I have sent my reception information about my listening to your station, and I hope that this report would be helpful for you. To make sure that I have been listening to your station, I'm enclosing an MP3 recording of my reception. I would be very happy if you could confirm that it really was your radio I was listening to. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We are so grateful for this email, Manfred Manke from Germany, one of our old and regular listeners. We are so happy to receive this email from you. Of course, your email is very helpful to us, because by your emails and your views, we can promote the quality of our programs. Manfred Monkey from Germany, thank you for everything. Please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as verification to your email. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you. So after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us a piece of email. Rob says, to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting English service, it's my pleasure to confirm your broadcast and I hope my report is correct. My name is Rob Den Boer and I live in the Netherlands waiting for a reply from your side. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's a pleasure to receive this email and we're so glad that the signals of IRIB English Radio are heard in your region, in your country, the Netherlands, and of course in your region. I don't know where city or town you live in, but you can tell us in your upcoming emails. Anyway, we are so happy to have received this email from you and it's a pleasure to have you with us as a listener in your upcoming emails. Rob Den Boer, please tell us your views about the programs you had and the quality of the programs. It's great. And please accept our EQSL or electronic QSL as verification to this email. Thank you. We wish you all the best. Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands. As I always say, art is long, but life is short, and we have to say goodbye to you. But before that, I do send my warm greetings and appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Aaron Teo from the Philippines, Avinash Chikat from India, Akiyoshi Taraoka from Japan, of course, Jawahar Almeida from India, and Manfred Monkey from Germany, and Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands. We had a great time being together. Please keep in touch with us. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, the U.S. President Joe Biden has ordered 3,000 reservists for European deployments, bringing the U.S. troop levels in that continent to over 100,000. That's for the first time since the year 2005. This is while during the most recent NATO summit, divisions have surfaced between NATO members on issues like Ukraine's NATO membership. In this edition of the program, we will look at the Ukraine war's endless military support and military action, a process void of a diplomatic push to end the war, despite Ukraine's counteroffensive setbacks. First, let me introduce our guests. Desha Krishnaswamy is a journalist and podcaster joining us from St. Petersburg. Also joining us, Frank Emspach, radio producer and political commentator, who joins us from Madison. Great. Welcome to you both. Frank Emspach, I'm going to start with you, and I'm double-checking the figure for these troops. It stands at 3,000, the number that the U.S. president has ordered to be activated in Europe, and that puts the troop levels to over 100,000 for the first time since the year 2005. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the last time we heard the figure 100,000 was during the war in Afghanistan. Why would there be such a massive troop buildup in European countries?
Well, I think that President Biden is trying to make a statement vis-a-vis Ukraine without sending any American troops to Ukraine. This increasingly looks like the same kind of rhetoric and political positioning that took place during the Cold War, when the Democratic presidents of the United States generally ran their elections on a combination of some investment domestically and mobilization against at that time, the Soviet Union internationally. And I think we're seeing the same type of model being applied here. Also, there is a way to try to deflect a political opposition that's growing amongst the right wing and the Republican Party to the war in Ukraine, and I suspect also growing in places in Europe as it becomes clear that the United States is not really interested in a settlement there. And that is getting some people uncomfortable, not that many at this point.
All right, well, talk about differences here. Esha, let me point out, I'm sure you're well aware of this, how Zelensky lost his temper. It was an unprecedented, somewhat of an incident where, when it comes to what has happened, it was about the wording, I guess, in the NATO summit, most recent NATO summit that happened, where you have basically him reacting in a way where he said that there shouldn't be any conditions that should be attached to the way that Ukraine should join NATO. What do you make, first of all, of Zelensky's anger when it came to that towards NATO as a whole?
Well, I mean, it is somewhat justified if you look at it from Zelensky's point of view, because since 1994, the U.S. NATO countries have been kind of dragging this reward, like bait along for Ukraine in order to mainly, a lot of these conditions are having to do with the kind of weapons, and they call it getting the military ready. And it's just, for the most blunt way to put it, is to get Ukraine to buy weapons from these weapons manufacturers. So from his point of view, he's completely justified. But, of course, we all know because of Article 5, if one is in the war, all of them have to join the war. And since that would involve multiple nuclear powers, it's not going to happen. And so it is that is the basic conundrum, is that NATO cannot actually have Ukraine join because it is going to mean a big World War III.
I mean, not to make it a big deal, Frank Emspach, but is it a big deal? I mean, let's take a look at, for example, who's against this. And at the forefront, it seems like it's the U.S. and Germany, who obviously are insisting on dialing back this NATO membership, invitation, if you want to use another word, be my guest. They both have told the Ukraine that you can't join because you can't have a country at war join NATO. The Ukraine minister actually said that Ukraine should show a lot of gratitude for weapons, where it was interesting when the Ukrainian foreign minister said, "I'm not Amazon." So what do you think about this, what appears to be cracks
between Abiy Zelensky.
I think we make up rules as we go along, you know, that are useful. It's pretty clear that the United States is a nuclear power. That if we say Ukraine's in NATO and Article 5, which requires all countries to defend somebody who's attacked, you're at war with Russia. And then Biden has said that. He says, I don't want to do that, which is a good thing, right? The other nuclear powers don't count, France, England. And we never took them seriously and don't now. So as far as he's concerned, it's in the interest of the United States, and I think of humanity, not to have a nuclear war with Russia. That's a good thing. On the other hand, the United States and a number of the other countries are not willing to recognize something which is obviously historically accurate, namely that Crimea has been part of what is Russia now since about the 17th century, and that entire part of eastern Ukraine is really Russian-speaking. And so if the position of our country is that Crimea goes back to Ukraine and everybody has to go back to square one, it's not going to work. And so to the extent that they're trying to draw this line of support to Ukraine but not have a nuclear war, okay, we understand that. But that's what it is. And I think that's pretty clear. NATO is expanding elsewhere. I mean, who ever heard of the North Atlantic being someplace in the Japan Sea? That which is where they were meeting about a month ago, if I recall. So you have still the development of an organization outside the United Nations, controlled by the United States, which isn't just Europe or in parts of the Middle East with Turkey, but looking at Australia, Japan, Singapore, South Korea. I mean, what are we talking about here? That is really what's going on as we move forward.
Okay, another instance of cracks within the alliance has come over something that maybe was not evident at first for it to show that, and that is the, election of a new NATO chief, which seems like they are very, insistent on keeping Jens Stoltenberg. What has happened there, Isha? Why is it that they don't want to put somebody else, even though there's been talk about it? And one of the interesting points about this is a number of NATO allies wanted a former head of state or government in charge. France insisted on someone from an EU country. The UK is not part of the EU anymore, but it didn't get the US backing. So there seems to be obviously divisions there. What do you make of it?
Well, the main vision, the main interest with Stoltenberg is that he is a hawk that it has promised unwavering support for Ukraine at any cost. And so they know that with him in charge, the NATO policy, whatever it is, it cannot be steered. But we also know that there are cracks within NATO. For example, the Turkey-Sweden issue. And of course, France is having some domestic issues as well as Germany. And so it's not a united front. And so France, I think, wants to step back again with this war because it's domestically too painful for them and too much shock. So I think that is the thing we're seeing. But what this ultimately shows is that NATO is 100% like the people in charge are the U.S. because it doesn't really matter what these other countries think. It's usually the U.S. policy that gets pushed forward.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, let's move on to another topic, which is of great concern, and I think it will continue to be as such, Frank M. Speck, and that is the whole issue of weapons and the quantities available. Now, an interesting statement came out from the UK Defense Secretary when it came to Zelensky's anger outburst, if you want to call it that, where he said in a message to Zelensky, you're persuading countries to give up their stock of weapons and ammunition. When he says that, what do you make of it? I mean, are they running that low, which would in turn make them vulnerable as a country in terms of their ammunition? Is that a general? Is that a correct assessment of it?
I have no idea. It's hard for me to believe that the United States is running out of ammunition, and therefore they can't give more to the Ukrainians, and we can't ramp up production here to meet the needs of the army and the Ukrainians, so therefore we have to give them cluster bombs. I mean, that's the line here. So it's hard for me to believe that, but it's possible. It's possible that because of the nature of the way the Ukrainians are fighting the war. I guess we have given weapons to lots of people. With these particular shells, howitzer shells, are not cheap or easy to make sometimes. So it's possible that we're running out of ammunition, and therefore it's a problem. The defense industry, of course, has their own interests here to squeeze as much profit out of this as possible. So it's hard to know what the actual level and whether it's really true. I just can't believe that we're not going to be able to defend Guam if we give more howitzers to the Ukraine. I think a more fundamental issue is, are we prepared to give them long-range strategic missions, missiles and whatnot, that are going to allow the Ukrainians to launch an offensive war against Russia? And that is the point that there's debate about, whether it's the F-16 fighter planes or whether it's certain types of missiles or other things. And I think there is going to be the where the rubber meets the road in terms of divisions within NATO, where the Europeans, who are going to bear the brunt of this, are saying, let's not do that. And here in the United States, there is pressure to increase the type and the scope of weapons we're giving the Ukraine. And that has happened pretty much since the beginning of this war.
All right. I'm going to get back to you on that point. But I'd like to ask you on another point that Frank Imspak talked about there, Isha, and that is F-16 jets, where Russia has said that that is going to be seen as a, quote, nuclear threat. And the reason they have given is its capacity to carry atomic weapons. Valid concern, do you think?
Absolutely. It definitely is capable of launching atomic missiles very close inside of Russia. So, yes, they can consider it a nuclear threat if Ukraine has a nuclear weapon head or a missile. But what is more dangerous is that it will allow for the war to come into Russian territory. For now, most, if you ignore the few incursions in Belgorod, it has been mostly contained inside of the Donbas region. So if there are F-16 jets, Russia would be legitimate to think that it is going to be more of like an offensive war that will hit Russian territory. So they will want to respond more aggressively, and that may include like hitting weapons caches or hangars in Poland, Germany, Czech Republic, wherever else the U.S. has decided to have their weapons cache. So it'll only escalate the war, in my opinion.
All right, Frank Especk, you talked about the F-16, and you talked about long-range, missiles in particular, that is something that is being debated, maybe thought of, but not provided yet to Ukraine. I'm wondering what the thinking is when it comes to the way, which has now been over 500 days, of how the U.S. has dispersed, along with its NATO partners, the military equipment to Ukraine. Because it seems like every so often they're releasing a new type of equipment. I mean, when the slow progress, first of all, now they've committed to $1.3 billion. The counteroffensive not going well, cluster munitions, slow progress before Abrams tanks. And you can see where I'm going with this. My question is, what is the thinking here when they're doing this? Because it's not that they're getting the desired results. So they're upping the, I guess, strength of the military equipment that they're releasing to Ukraine. Is that what the thinking is?
Well, it's an approach to war that's different, that you can win a war with increasingly sophisticated and targeted technology if you don't have the support on the ground. One of the reasons you fire hundreds of thousands of shells at somebody is because you don't have troops who are willing to occupy the territory without that kind of stuff. It has also not proved effective in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, Iran. So, it's a pretty fundamental issue. One of the interesting things about the tanks that we provided, there was a great video clip the other day that was distributed worldwide. Everybody saw it on CNN, Al Jazeera, and everything else, where these very, very expensive Abrams tanks going forward. And one of them got hit with something and stopped, and then the others went back because people weren't willing to risk $63 million or whatever each one costs. So there's limits to this. There's limits to, apparently limits to, the real efficacy of some of these weapons, because ultimately, if you're going to win a war, you have to win it on the ground, and you have to have motivated, trained troops to do that. And I think that's fundamentally the problem here for the Ukrainians, and I think for us. We've always, in the last 30 or 40 years, tried to, since including in Vietnam, try to win these wars with an overwhelming firepower based on whatever the most modern technology was at the time, combined with real weapon that are most people now have decided are war crimes, like cluster bombs, and aimed at civilians, incidentally. So that strategy doesn't seem to have changed here, but it also hasn't worked.
Well, you talk about cluster munitions. I'm just wondering, Esha, what it is when it comes to the definition of a war being won. I mean, when you take a look at the strategy here, what it looks like from the outside is that Ukraine is just trying to stop Russia from advancing. That's what it seems like they're doing. They're not on Russian soil.
Maybe, but what they've said, that their objectives, Zelensky has been very clear, and nobody has contradicted it. He said his objectives are to free Ukrainian territory, as he put it, from Russians, as well as getting back Crimea. Well, and that's what he says. That's what he says winning is.
Well, Esha, I'd like to get your idea on this, because there's a big difference by defeating Russia or stopping Russia. I think what they're doing is they're preventing Russia or stopping Russia from advancing, because that seems like the best they can do. And if you take a look at the Ukrainian territory, as a result, it's being decimated and destroyed.
Well, what we have to remember is that east of the Don River, there is no popular support. In fact, the chief of police in December said that the biggest problem for Kiev is the people of Donbas. And we know this because since like 2014, a lot of these oblasts declared independence, like not just Lugansk and Donetsk, but Kharkiv and even Odessa and Crimea. And with Crimea, they've always considered themselves to be Russian territory. And because of the events of Maidan, it motivated them to secede. So that is not a realistic objective, but stopping Russia is also hard. So in order to actually retake back the territories of Lugansk and Donetsk, they need to engage in full counterinsurgency, which is a war against the civilian population. And so, of course, that is the only option. Like, they have to do that because they do not have popular support there. So, but of course, the more realistic option, given the training, the military, and the state of the Russian military, is trying, not even stopping, but slowing down Russia's objectives, because Russia is actually going at a very deliberate, slow pace, because it's a war of attrition and not a war of conquest. And so, and of course, the U.S. only is used to fighting people or non-equal powers, so bigger and bigger firepower is not going to help in this war, and that's the only thing Ukraine is left with, unfortunately.
Taking a look at some of the consequences of this war that have been persisting for quite some time, may appear like Frank M. Smack, maybe it's not impacting the issues that I'm going to ask you about, such as energy, such as the grain supply deal with Russia, such as the way that budgets are getting drained, where you have these protests happening overall in Europe. I mean, those things are still matters of concern. I mean, right now we're in the middle of summer, pretty much in a heat wave, but winter is going to be coming around, and there are a lot of question marks as to the amount of storage capacity European countries have when it comes to their energy reserves, which is very doubtful that they can actually meet that. Are they not a bit at all concerned about what's going to happen then?
Are you asking me? I'll tell you, from the American point of view, okay, you've had a situation where a gas market, which had been previously closed to Texas and Louisiana and whatnot, is now 100% theirs. Gas exports are through the roof. So those guys are thrilled, okay? The second thing is conventional weapons. You know, they couldn't be running more hours per day. So those guys, Lockheed and the rest of them, are thrilled. So from that point of view, people are not, you know, those parts of the ruling class here are thrilled. Now let's talk about the grain people. What do they make their money on? They make their money in arbitrage, raising grain prices. Archer Daniel Midland and the rest of them. So they're not exactly running to the administration and crying here. So from certain ways, America, the American military-industrial complex, and the energy complex is doing quite well with the war just as it is. What the effect is on the Europeans and their standard of living, that's another question, okay, which is one reason there may have...
Which I'll leave. I'm sorry to jump in. I'll give that question to Esha. So, yeah. U.S. military complex at the expense of Europeans, you think? 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, of course, it is at the expense of Europeans because they are really hurting from the lack of cheap gas. And in fact, sometimes they have to launder Russian gas through India by paying a premium. And of course, it also has German industries because we've seen many factories shut down. So, of course, they're hurting. And this, again, shows you how non-sovereign a lot of these NATO countries are.
Pleasure. Thank you, Esha Krishnadwamy, journalist and podcaster from St. Petersburg. Frank Imsbach, thank you so much, radio producer and political commentator from Madison. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale with the team, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer.